reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listen later on aabluechipspeakers.org. We hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker comes to us by way of West Palm Beach, Florida. His name is Chris H., and his home group is the Hushton Group. Y'all give a round of applause for him.
Thank you, Missy. Hi, I'm Chris, and I am an alcoholic. And it's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. You guys got to hear my wife tell her story last week, and she apologizes for not being able to come this week, but she really enjoyed her time with you. So you might see us drop in here from time to time. This is a great group. My sobriety date is December 10th, 2001. I have a sponsor who had a sponsor, but his sponsor recently passed away. This happens when you get to be a little older in AA. I mean, people do eventually pass away, but he's going to get a new one. I'll tell you more about my sponsor in a little bit. I'd like to start off by saying this, you know, that just because, so that people who are like me can identify, that a lot of the people whose stories I hear, they had three strikes against them before, you know, they were out of the cradle, that, you know, their parents were alcoholics or drug addicts. They were maltreated when they were kids, you know, abuse, all kinds of things. They had older brothers and sisters that were, you know, drug addicts. I mean, they just had no chance of not being an addict or an alcoholic. And I get that. But then there are people like me, too, I had two normal parents, and they were really good parents. They were very loving parents. They took great care of me and my brothers and sisters, you know, and they did the best for us. I still believe that I inherited alcoholism. Alcoholism is, I don't know if you guys ever studied genetics in high school with little peas and stuff. We used to do that. Alcoholism is a recessive gene, which means it's expressed less frequently. So it can skip generations. So it skipped my parents. My parents' brothers and sisters, a lot of alcoholics. Their parents, a lot of alcoholics. So there's alcoholism all over my family, but I got lucky in that my parents didn't get it. But I believe I inherited it, because the first time I really took a drink, I loved it. It was, I was 14 years old. And I was in a boarding school at that time, not because I was a bad guy. It was because I wanted to go to this school. That's another story. Two other guys and I got a hold of a couple of bottles of wine, and we snuck out of the place in the middle of the night and went and climbed this mountain and sat up there. It was gorgeous. And we drank the two bottles of wine. I don't know. I thought I died and gone to heaven. It felt like one of those pinball machines in Las Vegas where you hit the jackpot and it's going ding, 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 ding. That was my brain. It's like, wow, I didn't know I was missing it, but this is it. This is absolutely the most fantastic feeling. I think it was just that my brain was just, it had all the right receptors. It was just waiting for the alcohol to be added to it, and we were off to the races. Because from there on, I had a drink. I got and got drunk every single chance that I could. Now, when I was 14, those chances were far apart, you know. But and as I got older, they got closer and closer together. Until I was, you know, totally on my own, and I was just drunk all the time. Was at 14, I started partying all through high school. It was, you know, just party hardy on the weekends. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you guys did the same thing. And, you know, I hung out with the people who partied, so I didn't stick out. I wasn't, didn't look like I was going overboard, although I could really drink a lot. I was proud of that, I was very proud of that. And during high school, I didn't really have any problems. Some of my friends did. I was coming home for a party one night, and I drove around a corner, and there's a Jeep upside down in the road, and a body laying there in the road. And I stopped and got out and looked, and it was one of my friends. But he looked like he was beyond help. And I said to myself, shit, if I stand here, they're gonna breathalyze me. So I got back in my car and hightailed it out of there. And there were two guys in that Jeep, and one of them did die. It sort of shook me up, but not in the right way. What I thought, I didn't think about, oh man, maybe I should watch my drinking and driving. I thought, boy, those guys should have been better at drinking and driving. I'm really good at it, but they obviously weren't. I clearly had the alcoholic thinking going right from the get-go. This disease was going to make whatever excuses, whatever explanation it needed to keep me going. High school went okay. Then I went to college, and in college I encountered some of the more interesting other substances. I was really, one of those garbage can people. You put it in front of me, tell me I'm going to like it, I'll do it. It did not matter what it was. Still was okay. And again, I was surrounding myself with people who were all doing the same thing. So there, I had no reason to really think that there was something wrong with me. As a matter of fact, just the opposite. I thought everything was great with me, because I graduated from college and then went on and got a decent job and all that. But the very first time I had a thought about, drinking, or was aware that I drank maybe slightly abnormally, came when I was on my honeymoon. I was 25 years old when I got married. We were, my wife's parents were from Portland, Maine, and we went up there and got married in the summertime. It was gorgeous. We got married on an island, and it was all beautiful. And we decided to go camping for our honeymoon, which is a little unusual, but it's such a gorgeous place up there. It seemed like the natural thing to do. So we're out camping, having a great time, and I'm like packing up the stuff in the morning, and it's like about, 8:45, and I catch myself thinking about when I'm going to get to have my first beer. The thought just occurred to me, that's a little weird. Here you are on your honeymoon having this wonderful time, and it's 8:45 in the morning, and you're thinking about when you're going to have your first beer. Well, I had that thought, but it went right out of my mind. Okay, fine. And, of course, I got my first beer as soon as I could, and life went on. And you know how the alcoholic curve goes. We all basically follow the same path. It starts out, it's fun, it's a lot of fun. We have a great time. And then we start to have a problem or two, a few problems. Then we have more problems. It's all right. And then more, and then it starts to get so it's not fun at all. And we finally end up where it's frickin' miserable. My curve took a pretty long time. So it was when now I was, about 30, 31 years old. I'm out of school, I'm married, and I have a decent job, not the world's greatest, but a decent job. I am absolutely getting shit-faced every day. I would come home from work, start drinking, maybe fire up a little something else, and keep drinking. Because alcohol was always my first, last, and, if it was the only thing I had, I was fine. Anything else was welcome. I would just drink until I passed out, basically. And I would pass out every single night. Every single night. I didn't really realize that. I called it going to sleep, but it was passing out and coming to. That is what I did. somewhere, I guess a year or two before I was 30, you know, 28 or 29, my wife, who was my number one party buddy, we'd met in college and, you know, just had a great time of the whole thing. She started to get migraine headaches, you know, really bad headaches. And, of course, drinking made them worse. So she goes, you know, I'm just going to stop drinking. And she stopped drinking. You know, she was a normie. She could stop drinking. Something became active in her life that gave her sufficient reason to stop, and she just did. And, of course, once she stopped, I started to stick out like a sore thumb to her, you know. She's like, look at him. He's a vegetable. He'd pass out on the couch yet again. She soon got tired of trying to coax me into the bedroom to pass out in there. You know, she just let me leave me wherever I was. And so when I was at 30, 31, she started kicking around the word alcoholic in my presence. I'm like, alcoholic? I don't even know what an alcoholic is. So I decided to do a little research. I found one test. I think it's called a CAGE test. I don't know. Hardly ever see it anymore, but it has only four questions on it. And so I answered all four questions, yes. And I turned it over, and it said, if you answered one or more of these questions, yes, you may have a problem with alcohol. I'm like, well, what a wimpy-ass test this is. Everybody I know would say yes to all these questions. And, of course, that was true, but I didn't really realize why, you know, because I only hung out with alcoholics, so I didn't stick out. I kept looking for more information on alcoholism or what an alcoholic was. I didn't even really know the word alcoholism. And I found another test, and this one had 20 questions on it. And you guys have probably seen this one. It's more common. And so I go down, and I start answering the questions, and I have yet to figure out that yes is a bad answer. So I go tick, 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 and I answered 17 of the 20 questions yes. And I turn it over, and it says, if you answered six or more of these questions yes, you do have a problem with alcohol. So I'm like, well, okay, all right, well, fine. So I'm an alcoholic, okay? I meet the definition. I pass the test. So, but I'm a functioning alcoholic. I mean, look at me. You know, I got a job. I got a car. I got a driver's license. I got a wife. She's a little pissed off, but I've got one. You know, I got it all going on. You know, so I'm a functioning alcoholic. I wore that label proudly. I actually was proud of that. You know, if somebody asked me what I was, I often would say, I'm a functioning alcoholic. Damn straight. And I could still drink almost anybody under the table, so, yeah, that's what an alcoholic is. Rawr, you know, manly alcoholic. Time went on, not much, because a couple years after that, or maybe even a year, I got a job offer in another state halfway across the country. It was a really good job offer. I was going to take it. I'm talking to my wife about it, and she goes to me, look, I can't stand to see you kill yourself with alcohol and drugs, so I'm not going unless you do something about it. What my alcoholic brain translated that into was, I'm not going with you because my job here is more important to me than you are, because she had a good job too. So I'm going to stay here. That isn't what she said. That isn't what she said at all. That's what I told myself, that her job is more important to her than I am. But no, she said, I can't stand to see you kill yourself with alcohol and drugs. So I packed up and left, you know, without a backward glance. You know, looking back, that really is sad because she was a really great woman. We liked each other a lot, you know. We had fun together, and she was really concerned about me. But, hey, she was threatening my drinking. to heck with that. See you later. So I moved off to another city in the middle of the country. St. Louis was where it was. And St. Louis, I don't know, somehow St. Louis was a great town for drinking. Not that it really mattered where I was. There, I had no restraints now. You know, I didn't have a wife to look at me funny or make remarks about alcoholism or anything. And I had a really good job, you know, that paid a lot of money. So I got to find out what happens. What happens if you just drink as much as you want for as long as you want? What happens? I mean, there's all kinds of crap that happens along the way. But at the end of that long, you know, path is this point that I got to where the alcohol stopped working. Now, I don't know if like just all the brain chemicals are worn out or what, but it just wasn't getting me buzzed and doing what it's supposed to do. It actually hit me. I was in England, and I was in England because I had been sent over there by my company with the wonderful job of closing a factory. In England and the rest of Europe, the law says if you're going to close a factory, you have to give everybody 6 months notice. So my job was to go over there, tell them all, hey, we're closing the factory, you're all losing your job, but we got to work for 6 more months, so let's go. You know, and needless to say, they weren't happy, and I must say they weren't mean to me or anything like that, but nobody was happy. And it was, I think I went over there like in September, and so 6 months, so it was all the winter time in England. And I don't know if anybody's ever been there in the winter, but the sun, you see the sun last maybe in August, and you don't see it again until June. It just, you know, it's just cloudy and overcast and miserable. And the days are really short because England turned out its way up there north. So it's miserable. I'm just miserable, miserable, miserable. And I'm drinking like a fish. On the way home from work one day, I stopped in the grocery store and bought 2 liter bottles of vodka. Went home to my little apartment. 3 hours later, both bottles were gone. And I did not have the buzz. I didn't have it. I'm like, you know, it's this, I'm not there. What do I do now? Do I get in the car and go out and get another one? Or what do I do? And I had one of those moments of clarity. It's like, buddy, you are effed. You know, you are really messed up. You know, you're considering getting in your car after drinking 2 liters of vodka to get some more. I mean, you are just messed up. So that moment of clarity, I made a phone call. I called my parents, and they were out of town, so I called my brother and told him that, you know, I'm screwed. And he said, wait a few minutes. Anyway, they sent a rescue party to come in and get me. That's a whole hysterical story, because you send more drunks to get another drunk. It's like very, very funny. But nonetheless, they got me back, and they took me to West Palm Beach. I'd never been drunk in West Palm Beach. I'd really never been to West Palm Beach before, but West Palm Beach has a ton of rehabs in it. Anybody been to rehab in Florida? It's a popular spot. But I went to go to rehab there, and when I got to the rehab, it was a really nice one because I had insurance at that time that would pay for a good spot, and it was one of those ones that had its own medical wing with doctors and all that. And they took one look at me and they said, "Man, he is in bad shape. Take him to the hospital, because we're worried that he's going to have a stroke as he detoxes." My brother took me over to the hospital, and I spent my first week in the locked psych ward. It was called St. Mary's Institute for Mental Health. So I was locked in there. The funny thing is, I did not feel out of place. The arts and crafts were right my speed. it was all good. And it was interesting. They had AA people from AA came in there and did meetings. And that was interesting. Those were probably my first meetings. I don't really call it my first meeting, but now that I think about it, those were. But I was just so out of it, I didn't really know what was going on. Anyway, after a week in there, they let me back into the regular rehab. It was sort of amazing because after detoxing and then after a week of being in the rehab, I started to feel good. Like, really good. And I think it was my body was just like, oh my gosh, he has finally stopped trying to kill me. You know, I was starting to recover a little bit. So I'm feeling like awesome. I actually went out, they had a little track, and I actually walked around it. It's like, I hadn't done intentional exercise for a long, long time. So that's going on. And then the next thing was, you know, they had the steps on the wall. This was a good treatment center. It was a 12-step base. They believed in all that stuff. So they had the steps on the wall. And I was reading them. The first one, admitted or powerless or alcohol or lies or unmanageable. Well, duh. You know, here I am, obviously. And then the second one, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'm like, I know what they're talking about, okay? They're talking about God. And I thought about it, and I I'll tell you this little thing, because God had sort of made a crack in my armor a little while earlier. And this was before I got into the rehab, but not long before, where I lived in St. Louis. I lived in an apartment, and it was a nice apartment. It was on the 23rd floor of this building. And right across the street from me was the Cathedral of St. Louis, Catholic Cathedral. Gorgeous building, beautiful, beautiful building. If you ever are there, get a chance to look inside it, do. Because it's amazing. And it's got this big green dome on top with this huge gold cross, you know, just there. And that is what I looked at out my window all the time. And I lived there for like 10 years. You know, I'm looking at this cross for 10 years. Toward the end of my drinking career, as my life is falling apart, I'm miserable, and I cannot stop drinking, it occurred to me that maybe I've been wrong about this God thing the whole time. You know, I had dismissed God out of my life when I was a teenager, and said, I don't need this God. The whole idea is screwy. It's for weak people who are scared about dying or something. You know? But I started to think that maybe I'd been wrong about it. And I actually went over into that cathedral a few times, drunk, and it didn't really do anything for me. But there was, you know, I think there was this calling. So when I was in that treatment center, and I'm reading that second step, came to believe, all of a sudden I had no resistance to the idea. I'm like, okay, maybe there is a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. I hope there is. So I softened to the idea, and then the next step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Well, I'm like, you know, if there is a God, he's the most powerful thing in the universe. He created everything. It only makes sense to turn my will and my life over to his care, right? Because, I mean, he's basically running the show anyway. So what the hell? So there I was. I had done the first three steps, right? Right while I was sitting there. And I started to feel spiritual. I had this little spiritual stirring in me, and it felt really good. Now, this might have been like the second or 1.5 weeks into the treatment center. So I'm feeling good, really good. My body's feeling good. I got a little spiritual glow going on. You know, I'm like skipping around this place, just going, wow, now I know why all the movie stars and rock stars come here. This treatment thing is great. This is awesome. And then I noticed another thing is that I started to be able to like read in the book and comprehend what I was reading and to talk in complete sentences. I'm like, wow. My brain is working again, you know. This is awesome, you know. I feel like Albert Einstein. This is great. And so now I got this three-pronged thing going. My physical, I'm feeling good. I got a little spiritual glow going. And my brain is ticking like a finely oiled machine. And, boy, I am just loving rehab. Loving it, loving it. Oh, and I don't know if anybody else has ever done this, but I guess I wasn't the only one in there that was like feeling this kind of euphoria thing, because this was that kept the men separate from the women in this treatment center. Wisely so at that point. So I would sit out front with the guys smoking cigarettes, and we would just laugh our heads off. Laugh, laugh, laugh. It was hysterical. I mean, I was really having a good time with the rehab. So I'm like, wow, this is awesome. And it was all going really good until my third week in the rehab. And it was sometime like in the middle of the third week, and we're in one of those groups, you know, where the guy directing the group, and we're all saying whatever bullshit we were saying. And I started to look around. Like, oh, my God. How did I get here? I mean, look at these people. You know, that guy's hiding out from the law. That guy said he's been in here 13 times. This other guy, his wife's, you know, leaving him, taking the house. I mean, they don't have their, they don't have job. They don't have driver's licenses. I got, you know, compared to them, I got it all going on. You know, I still got a house to live in. I got a driver's license, a job, car. I got it all. You know, compared to them, I'm a functional alcoholic. And it didn't even occur to me, you know, how ironic it was that that's what I've been calling myself for the last 15 years. I thought it was a new idea, you know. Oh, I'm a functional alcoholic, and maybe I was too hasty about coming to this rehab. I spent the last week or so in there planning how to test the theory that I was a functional alcoholic, you know. And I figured, I thought about it. I gave it a little thought. I'm like, well, you know, I know a little about this AA thing now. I can probably even go to a meeting or two. I know about alcohol, a little bit about alcoholism. They're assigning me a psychiatrist when I get out of here. I can use him. I can use all these tools, and I can manage it. You know, I'll manage this drinking. I'll be able to drink and manage it. Well, guess how that went. I got out of there, and the first day I decided to test it. So I went to the grocery store. I bought a case of beer and a bottle of vodka. Started drinking. Couple hours later, I'm on the phone, you know, calling up the Coke dealer, and got that going. And I mean, you know, by the end of day one, I am right back into the middle of the whole thing. Wasn't gradual at all. So that went on for like 3 weeks or a month, and then I'm like, oh my God, you know, here I am, I'm back doing the exact same thing. This is a mess. Oh, and did I mention that in that little bit of time I got fired from this really great job that I had that I thought I couldn't get fired from? You can't fire me, you know. And, oh, yes, I could. But it didn't stop me from drinking. But anyway, I'd go, you know, this is horrible. This is, you know, they were right. I can't control it. I called up that psychiatrist that they assigned me to. Of course, I hadn't called him before that, and said, oh, shit, I'm drinking again. And he goes, okay, all right, I'll make an appointment for you. And so it turned out it was only 3 blocks down from my apartment. It was a hospital with a locked psych ward. And there I was again in the locked psych ward. So I was in there for 3 days, and they gave me those nice little Librium pills is what they gave back then to detox with. And I loved it, you know. And after I detox, I go to myself, well, shit, this doesn't prove anything. You know, this wasn't really a test of whether you're a functional alcoholic or not. You just chucked yourself in here so you could detox with those stupid pills because you're such a wimp. And so I called my main drinking buddy up. He came pick me up, and we went straight to a bar. Yeah, oh, my God. And it didn't turn out well. I mean, needless to say. So about 5 months after that, I was back in the treatment center again. And this time I had to get sober. I had to. I knew it. So I was willing to do everything they told me. And one of the things they told me is stay here for a long time. And I did. I did. They really did know what they were talking about. So if anybody's in a program and, you know, you get to your 28 days and they say, maybe you want to stay a little longer, you might give that, pay a little attention to that, because 28 days was not long enough for me. I needed more. And like I said, this was a great rehab, and they taught me several things. They drummed it into my head that what I had was a disease, alcoholism. Probably a genetic disease, but anyway, I had it. That this disease is progressive, incurable, and fatal if left untreated. And I have since spent a lot of time looking it up in the medical literature and so on. That is exactly what it says in there. That's what the medical community thinks of it. And so if you want to live with this progressive, incurable disease, you got to treat it. And you have to treat it regularly. They said every day, and I believe that every day. And they said the only way, the best way we know to treat it is when you get you out of here, you get your ass to AA, get a sponsor, do what he tells you to do, and keep doing that for the rest of your life. And you have a chance at living a good, long, happy, useful life. And I was scared enough. When I got out of there, I did that. I immediately went to a meeting. I went to a 7 a.m. meeting. I was never a morning person. And I made that my home group. And it was an amazing group. I got a sponsor. And the sponsor started taking me through those steps. And boy, did my world change. And it changed pretty quickly. You know, it wasn't a slow process. I've seen people make it a slow process, but it doesn't have to be, and for me, it wasn't. One thing that happened 6 months in is one of my group members, really good guy named Gerald, it turned out that the Hospitals and Institutions Committee there, which was in Florida, that's how they take meetings into rehabs and hospitals and prisons. At six, you're allowed to join it after 6 months sober. So Gerald kept asking me, how long you got? How long you got? As soon as I said 6 months, he goes, come on. And we went to a meeting of that, and I signed up. And he goes, okay, good. Meet me at the State Work Release Center on Monday night at 7:30 p.m., I think it was. And we'll do a meeting. And so I met him there at 7:30, and we went into the work release center, and we did a meeting, you know. I'd only spent one night in jail, so prison was a new thing for me, but it was amazing. I don't know. I felt really good when we came out of there. You know, I felt like I'd done something useful. And so Gerald goes to me, well, great, good. So we'll meet back here same time next week. So next week I'm there at 7:30 on Monday night, and Gerald doesn't show up. So I got to do it by myself. So I did. I went in and did that meeting by myself. And Gerald never showed up again. He kept going to the group, but he was like, that's your meeting now. And I did that meeting every Monday night, and I started doing it even more often for 12 years. And it was amazing. It was, you know, it helped me change my life from being that alcoholic, you know, who knew that he was not doing what he was supposed to do, you know, with all the alcohol and drugs, and that I wasn't living up to any kind of potential that God had put me here on this earth to live up to. You know, I was not being useful to my fellow people, my brothers and sisters. And now, through AA, the steps had taught me how to look at myself, how to work on my character defects. And then, you know, this wonderful program had taken me into this institution. I got to do this meeting with these guys in the Work Relief Center, and it turns out it was really important because a lot of them were coming off of long sentences. You know, some had been in, they hadn't seen the world for 13 years. I had a guy in there who didn't know what a cell phone was. Be in an AA meeting and ease your way back into the world was very important. And I have several lifelong friends that I've made through there, guys who came out of there and really did well. But it wasn't me curing them or helping, you know, or doing anything, but I got to be useful. I was being useful. I was doing something that clearly my higher power wanted me to do. And wow, you know, that was just so amazing and powerful. And, you know, for that and a whole host of other examples just like that, I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, I am grateful that I am an alcoholic, because I never would have found that on my own. Me, this person, would have never walked into a prison and tried to be helpful to anybody. This program showed me how to do that, and because I was forced to do it by my disease of alcoholism. So, but I'm grateful for it all. And life today is wonderful. I could go on, but I won't. I'm running out of time. But early sobriety is hard. It's hard. It sucks. And you don't want to do it again. But as you progress in sobriety, it gets better. It really does. And it gets a lot better. It gets to where, you know, it's amazing. I'm just doing things. I do things on a regular basis. It would never, ever have occurred to me to do. And they're good things. You know, I used to get all kinds of ideas, and they weren't good. But now it's different. So I really encourage you to stick with it. It's an amazing way of life. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Chris. Like you, this program has also taught me there's a lot to be grateful for. We've asked Marley to come up and hand out the chips.
Hey, I'm Marley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Marley.
Here about the white chips, you want to surrender, you coming back.
First time in the room. Anybody want a white chip?
Go, girl.
Strange to me. As I roll from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge, you see. I got nowhere to hide, an empty hole inside. It's the Bible, the book, or the gun for me. Seems like everyone's out to get me. Trouble always following me. Feeling like I just can't outrun. And demons shatter all around me. Thank you.